busy agenda this this afternoon, so we'll start right off. We've got a transit-oriented development interim overlay district update or discussion. Who in Public Works is going to lead off here?
It's actually planning, sorry.
Okay.
This is Don Elliott, a consultant from Clarion.
And
Ryan from planning.
So we know you have a busy agenda. I will do this briefly. It's nice to see many of you again. We're back from Denver for our second visit. Some of you we haven't met before, but I'm Don Elliott with Clarion Associates, a land use consulting firm from Denver, based in Denver, that has been retained to draft over the next year a number of updates to the land development manual, the zoning regulations for the city, and I'm accompanied by Lisa Steiner from Clarion Associates as well. In our contract, there are four or five specific areas of the land development manual that we've been retained to update in a variety of ways, including infill and redevelopment and incentives. But the very first part of our contract was to put forth an interim TOD ordinance to try to hold the line against things that you might wish wouldn't have happened in the time that it's taking to think through the transit-oriented development policies and regulations of the city. So this is part of our contract. It is not unusual to have that type of ordinance be proposed and adopted when the city thinks that there is a high probability or a good probability that you're going to have development proposals in the next year, in the next limited period of time, that would be counterproductive given the long-term planning direction you're going in. And so, as part of, quiet, where are we proposing this? It's part of our contract. We were asked to do this. We talked about it with staff. I would, in the interest of your time, just like to make background. I have five quick points I'd like to make about the interim TOD ordinance, and then turn it over to Ryan to talk a little bit about the process that's been going through in terms of consultation and how this proposal has changed along the way in response to that exposure and transparency and consultation. So, the five points I would like to make to start with is it's not a moratorium. The ordinance says that in a defined area, which is basically North Broadway, South Broadway, a certain distance, 2nd and 4th, east and west of downtown, not including the downtown area, but in those key corridors, in that area, some time-limited restrictions would be in place for, we assume, the next year. Our contract says that within a year, we will have talked through the longer-term regulations and incentives and what should be done to promote transit-oriented development along these discrete areas. But it's not a moratorium. It says we want development going along during this ensuing year. We just don't want to have things that we'll regret having approved because they turn out to be counterproductive in the long term. So it's not unusual. A, it's not a moratorium. B, as I've said, we think it ought to be in place about a year. According to our schedule, we will have talked through these issues within a year. Three, we've deliberately kept it simple. Transit-oriented development is one of the hardest topics in zoning, which is what I do for a living. I write zoning ordinances that help cities implement their plans. In that firmament, transit-oriented and transit-supportive development is a relatively complicated process. For every question you answer, another question comes up. But what if this, and what if that, and what if, should we restrict this, or does it matter very much? All of that is part of our work program, and we have it on the schedule within the next year. You can't answer all of those things before you've actually consulted with all the property owners and stakeholders. And so we've tried to keep, the third point is, we've tried to keep this very simple. The fourth point is, we think it's a balanced proposal. It offers, in these areas, along the north, south, east, and west, a stems of the primary transit network, significant incentives in terms of development intensity, in terms of development height, in return for pedestrian-oriented designs facing the streets, things that would reinforce transit usage and discourage auto, and restrictions on some auto-oriented development for the period of a year. I have emphasized with the stakeholders that the fact that we have listed about 13 different uses and said during this year, we don't want to see these uses put fronting on these primary transit corridors because they tend to attract a lot of car and truck traffic that's going to want access in there and not as pedestrian-oriented. The fact that we've listed them doesn't mean they'll be on the list a year from now. That is one of the complicated issues. Does it need to be a no, or does it be a yes if? We can do fine. So to keep it simple, we've said, look, there's a left hand and a right hand. In the left hand, we say, we want you to build density. We want you to do more intense development along here during this time And we all, but on the right hand, we don't want you to do auto-oriented uses that are listed, and we also want you to do pedestrian-oriented design facing these corridors. I will say, in anticipation of what Ryan may tell you, some of the initial reaction we had to this was, oh, it's a moratorium, you don't want me to do anything. Upon reading the incentives that we held with our left hand while we put the use restrictions with our right hand, a number of people said, I don't have a problem with that. That is, I understand what you're doing. So that's what we're going on. The fifth point I would like to make is, well, what if I need more flexibility? This ordinance doesn't restrict any of the other tools that are in the land development manual that allow a property owner to go in and say, I have a special situation. I need a variance. I need an exception to this. I need some other way to do this, and I can explain why I'm different, just as I would ordinarily under the land development manual. So those are kind of the 5 points. It's not a moratorium. It's must be temporary. We deliberately kept it simple. I know you can ask questions that we have finessed and said, look, that's a longer-term thing. We think it's a good balance of gives and takes during this interim period. And we've left intact the flexibility tools that the city has right now that allow you to go and ask for an exception. And I think with that, I'll turn it to Ryan to talk about how the process went.
Sure. So I think Don's answered most of the questions that we've received, but I want to go through real fast on what kind of the process has been and how the documents changed throughout that process. Just real quick background, as Don laid out, this is intended to be a relatively simple ordinance in place for 1 year. The P2S 2040 emphasizes the connection of land use and transportation and how those two aspects work together and their importance on a successful bus rapid transit system. And then the last thing I'd point out is P2S 2040 and DMC have both presented a vision to reduce traffic going into the downtown area. This is a step in that direction. As Don laid out, this isn't a moratorium. It temporarily restricts selected audio uses. Like he said, a year from now, we could decide that those aren't the audio uses we want to restrict. I understand there was some question around the applicability. This is the statement that was added that wasn't in the document the first time you guys saw it because we received questions about that. And this basically lays out how it works if you have a project already in the pipeline. This essentially says if you're already in the pipeline, you're judged under what you were judged. This doesn't affect you. Public meeting highlights, when we came, the first thing I'll address, and I'll lay out the definition in a minute here, but essentially drive-in facility is what you think of as a drive-thru. The definition will show you in a couple slides, but what you're envisioning as a drive-thru, that's a drive-in in our LDM definitions. So when we came here the first time, we had the original language was fast food restaurants with drive-in facility. We were, you folks requested that to be changed to drive-thru facilities, meaning all of it. Mm-hmm. We made that change to the document, went to planning and zoning as a discussion item. There, they flagged and asked that we consider increasing the FAR to something higher than 2.0. They asked for flexibility around the prohibiting of drive-thrus. They asked if there was design things that could be done.
Question here.
Sure.
FAR.
Floor area ratio.
Thank you.
The amount of building you can build on site.
Yeah. Perfect.
They asked if there was design things that we could do to make drive-thrus okay in the interim period, such as location of the drive-thru not crossing in front of the building, that type of thing. The last thing that they questioned a couple of the uses that we chose. However, after the commission and Don talked through them a little more, generally they agreed that what was on the list was okay to be on the list. From there, that same document went to a transit-oriented development stakeholder group that's been put together. We heard a lot of the same things. One of the things different is they asked if we should consider going further south down 52, they threw out the Highway 52 interchange. They asked for clarification. One of the aspects of the ordinance explains that if you're expanding by more than 25% and you are one of those, or and you're not one of those restricted uses, they asked some questions around how does that work. For example, the setback. If you're already set way back and you're going to add on to your building, do they expect you to cut the bottom of your building off and move it up? The whole building within that, and so there's language in there to address that. they asked if there should be a minimum height density or a minimum density requirement, and likewise they questioned if there should be a maximum building length restriction. They asked about vehicle drop-off points on PTN frontage, and they also suggested a larger floor area ratio. So these are the modifications that we've made, taking all of that into consideration. We recommend maintaining the boundary as was laid out before. Can get into more explanation of that. I think the simplest reasoning behind it is we stopped there because that was where PTN Node was. That was the largest reason. There are other reasons involved in that, but it made sense for the interim to stop at the node. With the drive-in facilities, this is some language that we proposed. It's not exactly what you guys had said the first time we came, but if you would prefer the language that was there the first time you came, you could always recommend that instead. But this reads, drive-in facility or driving lanes leading to or from driving facilities are located between the building facade or front corner lot, facade and front or corner side lot line. If the frontage has PTN corridor, this restriction only applies to the PTN frontage, meaning if it's a corner lot, it's the PTN side that we're concerned with, not the other side. And then below that is the drive-in definition. And so if you chose to prohibit all drive-in facilities, we would simply say drive-in facilities are prohibited. And then lastly, with the FAR, the floor area ratio requirement, what we're proposing is 2.0 for a regular building. If you're building just residential, you're increased to 3.0. And if you're building mixed-use residential, the incentive is FAR 4.0. So the options is to consider the approval of the interim ordinance. If council wishes to proceed with the adoption of this text amendment, they should, by motion, instruct the attorney to prepare an ordinance for adoption, or the second option is to continue the item tonight and continue community engagement. With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions, comments?
Just maybe add a little bit of additional context to that. So, you know, obviously this is an interim ordinance. I don't want to understate that fact. I mean, certainly, you know, this is a precursor to something larger, as, you know, has been indicated. However, it does impact, you know, two very significant commercial corridors, or three significant commercial corridors, and there has been some feedback that we've received that would allow, or would people would appreciate the opportunity to provide some additional feedback and actually just have a better understanding of how this impacts their specific properties. I think this planning team did a great job of engaging with the stakeholders group, but I think when you're rolling something out to this large of a base of properties, you know, certainly there's the opportunity to make sure that people fully understand what this means to them. And so I think as part of your discussion, certainly ask you to consider that. And I know we've provided some supplemental materials about the stakeholder process that the planning team, you know, led through and all that. And I think the other part, you know, as we go through the land development manual process update, probably most importantly is as we go through the permanent components of these plans to really have a very intentional engagement strategy. And I think, you know, the group is really committed to doing that.
So. All right. Mr. Campion.
So I just want to cover this from the bottom up. So we have a zoning that applies to all of these parcels. The overlay sits over top and acts as a read-through, right? So you read through that zoning to the base zoning. When you get situations where someone is using either conditional use or an incentive development, do we need to set a special max density that would reflect maximizing some of these numbers that are up here, or is it still going to be the underlying? Because I think there's a situation where you might get the underlying's maximum, even under an incentive development, would be exceeded by our kind of what we're sitting here as a standard. Does a standard overrule like what an incentive development would allow, or vice versa?
No, I would say this would overrule.
Okay.
There is still incentive development, though. I mean, if they wanted to go larger,
and what we would
go through incentive development.
And just to be clear, what we would see is the incentive development taking the overlay values and exceeding them, even though our base zoning category seems to suggest some maximums. Or do we need to cover that in this ordinance?
Well, if they're under those, then they wouldn't need to go through the incentive. That's kind of the incentive. They wouldn't have to go through that. If they're over it, yeah, they would have to go through that.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to distill it a little bit because I have a very peculiar question, which is the maximum available floor area ratio is established in incentive development projects by either the base zoning or by what we set in here for the 4.0.
No. Mark, do you want to address that?
So under an incentive, the applicant can bring forward almost any number to you for your review, and under the way the ordinance is structured, we would identify a modification.
Okay, so this would be a modification. Okay.
So this would, if somebody proposed, so let's say under the current ordinance, your FAI is 2. At 3 and we're doing a mixed-use development, we would say as long as they're meeting everything else, they could go through that by right.
Okay.
If they were proposing 6 and 4 is the number, they would still have to come forward just as they would today under the incentive development. In our staff report, we would identify the TOD items that are there, you know, how far you set back and all of this. We'd be giving you that as information to make to facilitate your discussion and approval denial.
Okay, and that's what I wanted to make sure of as we set these maximum floor area ratios. If there's projects that have a convincing narrative for why they should be allowed to exceed that, that we have some framework to allow for that. So I appreciate that,
Mr. Russ.
I think what we're hearing is just people that are concerned and maybe a little confused about what this all means to plans that they have. So with that, who would they contact to get some clarification on that?
As it says here, maybe this provides clarification right here, is if something's submitted before this was voted on, then they're under the old, what was already.
I understand that, but I'm saying for, you know, things that are in, that I haven't maybe got submitted yet, but are in the works, I think there's some questions that people have.
Yeah.
And so Who would be the staff contact person? Would it be you or
Mark?
Mark?
So, like in any project, if they have questions, I'm consulted and asked on a number of projects, a number of the times on Jeff, Mr. Elgorsch, myself. So the process really hasn't changed. Where Ryan may be leading this portion as the ordinance, but we're all very aware of what that text says. If there's a conversation to be had, we're happy to sit down.
So anybody that has concerns can just call the planning department and ask to talk to someone about the particular concern.
Yeah, TOD, if they start with Ryan and Ryan has questions from there, we'll bring in whoever the appropriate individuals are, the folks that I know. I've had a number of conversations with consultants and developers on that exact topic, but we'll continue to do that now and into the future, I'm sure.
And for the most part, when you've had those conversations, they all seem satisfied with the results that they're hearing back?
I think each one has a different context of what those questions are. I don't know if I would say satisfied, because I don't know what each of their contexts are, but we're trying to provide them the information that this is the intention behind it.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Thank you.
Mr. Wojcik.
So I appreciate, too, staff sent out the sign-in sheets from some of the community engagement. My understanding is the folks from the chamber and the area builders have been involved in this from the start when we kicked it off. Is that correct?
Area builders, yes. I would have to double check.
Okay.
I don't know all the names.
Well, I saw Mike's name on the one of the sign-ins, so I know the chamber's been involved too. You know, and I guess I go back to we all, as we've been working on the comprehensive plan, there was at one point where we weren't supposed to call it an executive summary, but there were some points put up that do you all agree with this? And, you know, there were some very specific things in there. You must integrate land use and transit. There are certain uses that can't be applied in certain areas. We need density in certain areas. And it seems to me that this TOD ordinance is exactly what we all agreed to at that point. So to me it seems that it's something that does need to go forward. Now, I understand that one of the things that we're not used to doing here is we're telling people there are certain things that don't belong in this corridor. And we're saying that because there are, in fact, certain things that don't belong in this corridor if we're going to have actually be able to support the transit that's along there. But not every place can be all things to all people. And at some point, if we're going to have if we're going to implement the vision, we actually have to make the decisions. And it seems like this is part of that. I do want to ask staff, though, because I thought the direction from the council was pretty explicitly clear on the drive-thrus. And I'm trying to understand staff's perspective on, well, maybe we should allow some drive-thrus. What, when is having drive-up facilities good for transit-oriented development?
Right. I don't disagree with that statement.
Okay.
Our opinion of it was, we heard from you folks, then we didn't hear that same thing from any of the other groups we met with. We felt like this language was a compromise between them, so it's still pedestrian-friendly design by being up close to the building and the vehicles aren't crossing the front of the building and that type of thing. So we felt like it was a compromise in the interim, while knowing very well that if you all disagreed with it, you could go back to what was there before.
So just, you know, a couple of points. You hit on the pedestrian-friendly design, but it seems that as soon as you prioritize automobile-oriented businesses, you've taken away the density that's required, and that seems like it would be a huge a downside to doing this. And then, you know, you mentioned the need to put a compromise in here, but my understanding from the discussion we just had is restricted development is still an available tool, right? Mm-hmm. So because restricted development is still available, we can codify what we expect to see here, and if somebody really wants to make a case that a drive-through is good for the transit-oriented development in this district, they can still go through that process, right?
Yeah.
So there's still an avenue if that, and that's, my intention was I wanted to, you know, put in the language that the council had indicated that we'd put in, and just have the restricted development there available for those cases.
Yeah. I don't disagree with anything you said.
Okay.
And if you all feel that language is better, this was just a proposed one, you could recommend a change.
Okay. I mean, what I'm trying to do is keep it consistent with, you know, that overarching, what is this corridor going to be? What do we need to do to make this corridor successful? Understanding that if we fail to hold up our bargain, what we're really telling the taxpayers of Rochester is you're going to pay substantially higher taxes because we couldn't stick to our policies.
Mr. Hickey?
So I do like the staff recommended language on the driving facilities. So right now, the conversations I've had with maybe existing businesses, and recognizing this is just an interim, but I think there's, you know, along the idea of continued discussion to maybe answer questions on this before we adopt the final language, there's certainly an apprehension that that does become the final. I think of an existing business there, like you know, the Dairy Queen, that type of thing, and they just have apprehension that they're going to be, you know, limited what they could do with their business in the future. So I think some of this maybe is just dialogue and just explaining, you know, how this will or will not impact them. But I just think a little more discussion is necessary.
Mr. Campion.
So I thought the build-up here did a pretty good job of explaining it. Like, some of this is aspirational, because if we don't take a step now, we may never have the opportunity. And I think I described this to someone as changes along this corridor have a long lifespan. It's, you know, it's 30, it's 40, it's 50 years before these development opportunities come up again. So if simply articulating our vision is that this corridor should be transit oriented. And that is why we're making millions upon millions of dollars worth of investment into transit to service this corridor. That's really a message I think needs to be really upfront and powerful about this. To me, the language that is here for the drive-thrus, I don't really understand. I think I would want to kind of, maybe you guys can explain some of the designs that would be allowed versus designs that wouldn't be allowed. But to me, a broader stand is the aspirational goal that we do not have drive-thrus in this corridor. That's not saying no, never. There's an exception process. That's well documented and frankly well traveled by anyone who's done development in our city for any amount of time. They've been through these processes. So, in my mind, I understand the reluctance to tell people that what they can't do. But the reality is that's literally what this overlay district is about. This is about articulating the things people can't do with the property, because it reduces the return on investment of the huge investments the city is making in the transit. If we cannot do this, then I think we really need to question the overall strategy here. I mean, that's really what's laying out. If we're not willing to stick to the guns here about the land development, I think we have to be really concerned about making the transit investments. Mm-hmm. That it's both or it's none in my mind.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, and you know, some of this discussion may be, you know, more towards the final ordinance than this interim. But again, I would just like to see, clearly, I'm more worried about the existing businesses. I understand this is the vision for the future. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of trepidation. You know, if my business is restricted, now I can't sell it, now I can't expand, now I can't whatever. So I just want to be deliberate how we go through this and put in safeguards for existing businesses. Again, I recognize this is the future, and I'm less concerned about restricting future development.
But, and it seems like the only question on the table right now is a request from some parties to have a little bit more time just to review the language or ask questions of staff or the consultant, right?
I think that's part of it. You know, I think generally speaking, there's a desire to have, I think as you guys have discussed, to have a, you know, for certain individuals to have a better understanding of how this specifically impacts their property. Certainly we can do that. We can do that whether the ordinance is adopted or not. I mean, if we adopt it, we're going to still work with that. And if needed, we can certainly bring forward some changes. If you elect to wait, it provides that opportunity to do that on the front end. So I guess we'll be looking to that. I think clarity on the drive-through requirement component, you know, it seems like there's some discussion in that area. So I think policy feedback, you know, as you consider, it's on the agenda this evening. You have two options that are, you know, laid out here, basically. So you can go either direction for it, but definitely there is a desire to have that engagement.
Mr. Bilderbeck and Mr. Campion.
I guess I have a quick, my question is for the city attorney. What we're being asked to do tonight, one of the options is to ask you to make this ordinance, to draw it up. If it went to you tonight, how long before it would come back?
Next meeting.
Mr. Campy.
And that's a really good point, and I think a good example is the aperture for discussion doesn't close once we initiate mm-hmm. the text amendment. Because I'm assuming this is going to come through mm-hmm. the text amendment.
Fine.
That just begins the exclusionary process. So again, the applicability will start as soon as we start that. So for new projects. But anyone that comes forward with, frankly, a good narrative about how or what should be changed about this between then and yeah. now, we have a willing audience. I think you have people that have asked for this. It does set a really real timeline for getting those, you know, getting that feedback in. So I think it sends a message very clearly that this process is moving to conclusion, and we would like to have that feedback consolidated. In my mind, you know, that is always one of the challenging points of these projects or this process of legislation is once you take that leap to initiate the legislation, at least we've bounded the timeline. We've started the process. We now have legal protections for what we're trying to do. They have legal protections for people who are already in the pipeline. I think it's time. I think, again, it still preserves for some of those people that have those outstanding questions all the opportunity to come in and make those changes.
Mr. Wojcik.
I mean, it's an interim ordinance, which means anytime four of us want to switch something up, we can switch something up. And, you know, I haven't heard any compelling cases for things that need to be changed in here, but certainly anything that was presented to me, I'd be happy to consider it on its merits. But I think every development that happens that doesn't fit the vision for the future is one more step backwards, a little bit less efficiency, a little bit less return on our investment that we're getting. And I do say too, I understand Mr. Hickey's point about the existing businesses as well. And the key thing here is that, you know, we all understand the grandfathering process that goes in, but not all businesses always understand that. And, you know, it's important that their existing rights, they're not losing anything that they're doing today. Certainly how the site could be redeveloped in the future will change and needs to change. But, you know, and things like in the street, you know, right now it's pretty much left in, left out anywhere, which is, you know, very dangerous for the kind of modes of traffic that we're trying to promote. So, you know, some of the things are changing, but I don't want to do anything that will change the existing businesses' private property as well.
Can I just ask him, I think that's a really good point about existing businesses. And was there any example of what we could do to better facilitate that? Was it just, I mean, instead of a wholesale exemption, is it like this amount of change? Is it the 25% threshold that's the problem, or is it?
So, I mean, the ones that come off the top of my head is the Dairy Queen. Yeah. Like, hey, I'd like to remodel, and I'm not going to be able to do a, you know, if I choose to remodel my business, now I'm going to be restricted. So, again, just want to be deliberate, and again, perhaps it's the final ordinance, not the interim. You know, what, how we codify these safeguards for existing businesses and still maintain this, you know, vision for the future.
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, Dairy Queen, if they wanted to expand, and I don't want to just take one example, but this is a good example. If they wanted to expand, their use isn't prohibited. So they would not be prohibited to expand at all. All they couldn't do is add a new drive-through, yeah. Unless it was with this.
And they don't even have a drive-thru.
Right, and that one doesn't have a drive-thru. Right. But there was another one came up, O'Reilly Auto Parts on North Broadway. Mm-hmm. That's not a restricted use. That's a commercial use, right? And so you have to be really, you have to think through what the actual use is. There's really not that many along this corridor that would come into play on this ordinance. And if they wanted to expand, they would just have to stay under the 25% threshold or go through a process to request more.
Yes, sir.
If I write, I'm not going to weigh into the issue that's in front of you tonight in terms of your decision, but I wanted to mention this discussion here is kind of an example of how TODs get complicated. It's very easy to ask questions that need to be, that go to the next level of nuance and detail down the road. And that is why the basic answer to many of these questions are the incentive development, the restricted development, the nonconformities, all of the tools that you have now to deal with unusual situations stay in place. That's the basic answer to the what about this situation, what about that situation. We just can't draft it until you draft it. So I'm kind of explaining why, that's why we try to keep it simple, because you say, look, you've got a whole set of tools to deal with the unusual and the unexpected. Those stay here. They stay as flexibility during whatever period of time.
All right, anyone else? The only other comment I was going to add is that I've heard that mentioned multiple times we could use the existing restricted or incentive development process, although I would say that this council has not been particularly receptive to those kinds of projects, or at least they receive a high degree of scrutiny. So I would not want to placate someone to think, oh, I can use the incentive restricted process and then have perhaps this ordinance be held out as, nope, can't, because so if we're going to say that as it's a viable avenue, I just want to be honest that we would actually consider that if the occasion rises. Mr. Campion.
I agree with you. It's a high threshold. I think someone has to have a narrative that shows, you know, in particular they exceed some reasonable threshold for, you know, going outside the rules. But it hasn't been uncommon during my time on the council for people to pass incentive developments, even though maybe I've been on the losing side of some of those bills. So it is what it is. But I think the tools are there. It's, you know, again, our best judgment on when to use them.
All right. Aaron?
Yeah, just one suggestion. However you elect to handle this issue this evening, whether you elect to direct the city attorney to prepare the ordinance or to kind of lay it over for additional feedback, I think in either condition, we can certainly, given that we have kind of this fifth Monday of the month, which is always a magical thing in local government, but we do have that intervening week potentially to, you know, get some feedback and to facilitate an open house where people have the opportunity to come in and talk about how this specifically impacts their property and or give them an opportunity to provide feedback on some of the performance standards, right, if that's something you'd like to see happen.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'd like to move along, especially since we'll be considering this topic this evening anyway. So, good food for thought. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Moving on to the city owner contract update. Mr. Fries?
I'm amazed at how many people sit in your line of sight. That just isn't a good setup in that regard. So I'm going to be brief today on the city owner contract process. We've got a PowerPoint that we're going to quickly go through. There's a lot of information here. We've sent it out in advance. You've got a chance to see it. This is the second year of the two-year pilot program. I want to acknowledge Kevin Quisley, who's here in the back. Kevin, raise your hand. Kevin is our lead technician on our city owner contract process, and he's put together the PowerPoint. I was responsible for getting the filing the results from the survey and everything. So we're just going to go through it. We've have a regular engagement process with the Rochester Area Builders as part of this, and so these are the results. So again, we've got four groups that we that are part of the process here: the developers, the contractors and builders, consultants, and obviously city staff. And so in 2015, we assembled a task force, again, working through the Rochester Area Builders. There's about a dozen people who participated, and we basically, with the directive and support of the council, said we want to address quality. Quality needs to be improved on our city owner contract process. How can we go about doing that? We came up with a process, some recommendations, and requested, and you agreed to a two-year pilot program. So 2016 and 2017 were those 2 years. Last year we reported back, generally positive feedback, and there were several process changes that needed to be incorporated, and we've gone ahead and implemented those. So we made those changes in 2017. I'm not going to read them for you. Again, they're on the screen. You've got a chance to look at this, but those were implemented. Again, second year, now it's been complete, 2017. We've got, again, got some feedback from stakeholders. Again, some process issues more than anything, and we're addressing those. So changes to implement in 2018. Rather straightforward here, a standard notice to proceed form. The metrics that we're using to measure compliance and success, use better use of the website, and a pavement metric is being developed to track the pavement condition index for each project as we move forward. So as part of the pilot program, we ask that you agree to contribute dollars prior to the pilot program. The developer paid for everything. And we ask that in order to move this to the next level from a quality perspective, the pavement design, additional geotech services, and asphalt coring, after the pavement has been laid, be city's expenses. You can see that it hasn't cost very much for the city participation in this. We're very pleased by that, and we think it's actually this minor investment that you've been making is going to produce very good results. So, again, this year we surveyed all of the stakeholders, including the city staff this year. We actually didn't seek input from our staff last year, so we've done that. And what I wanted to reflect in these series of slides is the level of participation that we received as a result of the survey and the feedback. So you can see the number of invites sent. 96 people were invited to participate this year. We only had 19 respondents. And again, going through the series of questions here, again, the most important thing here is, I think, from my takeaway on this, is that the results haven't changed much from one year to the other, but the number of respondents has actually gone down, and that's a little disheartening as we've, again, tried to have a lot of engagement of all of the stakeholders, but the number of respondents has gone down. So again, I'm not going to go through these for the sake of time and go through each one of those. If there are particular ones that you have questions about.
Do you think perhaps the reason for less response is that they feel that it's been asked and answered and done in their mind?
I really don't. I don't know. That's a possibility, I guess, but I really don't have a good feel for it one way or the other. But again, the results are rather consistent, but the sample size was larger, and the number of respondents was smaller. So,
okay.
So I think we'll just cut right to the chase here. So again, we've been collecting data. We've got metrics here. The number of projects were about the same. We did see a slight increase in the cost of inspection. The inspection hours are reflective of the number of projects and the size of the projects. The pavement design costs, again, are going to run right around in that $10,000 a year range. I think the most significant thing on this particular chart is the projects with increased pavement sections from the minimum. The city used to have a minimum standard, 4 inches of bituminous over 8 inches of rock, okay? And everything was designed that way by and large as it relates to city owner contracts, which primarily were residential subdivisions. Last year, in 2016, we actually saw that there was 14 of the 18 projects where we actually had to change that and increase the pavement section. and that will result in a longer-lasting road, a better section, if you will, to handle the wheel loads and everything else associated with that. This year, we only saw 5 of 7 projects. So again, quite a high number, percentage-wise, but a lot fewer projects this year that we actually had to see that happen. And asphalt coring, again, we have we're taking cores this spring, right?
This spring will be.
Yeah, so we don't have the data for the cores yet, for the 2017 projects.
So just to make sure I'm reading this right, there are 33 total projects, 7 of which required the increased pavement consideration, and 5 of the 7 that were considered had to have increased road built.
Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong here, but basically there were 33 projects. Not every city owner contract project has a pavement section associated with it. It could be just a water main going around a commercial building. But of the 7 the projects that did, we needed to increase the section in 5 of them.
Okay, so 19 of 25 over 2 years. So there are 25 yes. pavement sections laid in all these projects over 2 years, yep. and 19 of them required. Wow. So 80% of them required more yes. than our minimum.
Yep.
Okay. Well, and that's a really good thing we're checking.
And again, the city's paying for the pavement design based on the soil borings that are being collected to make that determination.
But not paying for the difference in the quality of the material.
Correct.
That's on the developer.
Correct.
To,
okay. Yes.
Perfect.
So again, here's just a table that shows as the... As you're aware, you see these on your agenda quite often where the city has entered into a contract for the private consultant to do the inspection, which is paid for by the developer. That's been a significant, probably the most significant change in the program. What we do is we use this observation oversight matrix to have the consultants, as they put together their proposal, to determine the level of inspection that's necessary. And you see in most categories, we have recommended and have been requiring 100% full-time inspection of various activities on the projects. So staff recommendation, since there are still some process changes that need to be addressed that have been identified through the surveys, we recommend that you continue the pilot program for another 2 years, that we can continue to gather the data and report back to you annually, and that the city continue to fund the pavement design, the extra geotech inspections, and the asphalt cores. So again, it's been running on an average of about $10,000. We're saying, you know, based on the level of development, could be maybe as much as 20. That would be money that would be funded in the engineering budget. So right. That's our recommendation. Again, we've met with the Register Area Builders. We presented that to their working group, the task force that was developed. Again, they were in support of this recommendation to continue the pilot program.
Okay, Mr. Ruskin?
I think it's good stuff. I'd like to get good feedback here, good information. I'd like to see us continue it for 2 years. I think we're raising the standards, and everybody is understanding that, so mm-hmm. keep moving forward.
All right. Anyone else? Any other comments?
Ditto.
Is there a consensus then to consider or continue the pilot?
Yeah.
I see everyone nodding yes. Ms. Johnson?
Does this need to go to a vote, or... is this decided here?
Well, we need to do it. I don't know if this comes forward as an RCA, but we wanted to just get consensus today. So
I don't need an RCA if your direction is sufficient for us to continue in that regard.
No,
Jason doesn't want to do the resolution
okay.
in that regard.
Okay, yeah. I'm just making good. Sure. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. You can write one if you want.
No.
All right. Anything else? All right. Thank you. Moving on to our next topic is the Rochester Area Bicycle Master Plan. Who wants to lead off on that?
So Dylan and I will stay up here and work on this one with you. Actually, I'd like to probably combine this one and the next agenda item together, which is the complete streets, to kind of go hand in hand. And I think the council's concerns and comments here are directly related to both. So just want to give you a quick overview of the Bicycle Master Plan and how it is used as part of the complete streets process. So the Bicycle Master Plan was, there's several key principles here, creating a network of bicycle facilities that provides reasonable access to the network and service to key destinations throughout the community. These are all listed in the current plan to promote the use of bicycles as a viable and attractive alternative and to provide for safe and convenient bicycle travel. And then there were also goals that were set forward. Again, and these are contained in the plan. Reduce travel conflict between bicycles and other modes. Develop a network of bicycle travel corridors. Ensure that all areas have access to the network. Improve supporting facilities and services. And increase the number of bikeway system users. And the share of people using that. So as part of the adoption of the Bicycle Master Plan, there was a lot of community input. Again, this was done, I don't know if it's actually correct for me to say, as an outreach effort of the updated long-range transportation plan, but it was done in conjunction with the last update back in 2011 and 2012. A lot of community input from around the community. Neighborhood plans were taken into consideration from some of the close-in city neighborhoods such as Petoskey and Slatterly and East Side Pioneers, Southwest, Historic Southwest, as well as other community members who came forward. So there was a lot of public input as part of the development of the plan. And as a result, there was a system master plan that was developed that looked at such things as regional bikeways and major city bikeways, local bikeways, and express routes. And then there was identification of certain study corridors or study areas as it might relate to alternative routes. So all of that was information was gathered and was put together as part of the plan. Many of you will remember that there was actually a map, an individual ward map, that basically showed some preliminary improvement recommendations for each of the six council wards within the community, identified such things as where shoulder bike lanes should be, where actual on-street bike lanes should be designated, those areas where maybe a Sharrow or other type of bike facility might be appropriate as part of the network within for each particular ward and how that was integral to the overall citywide bike network. So as I had reflected in the previous presentation, we have been collecting data, and we basically have bike user data that we collected in 2012 and again in 2016 on some of the corridors. And really, right, this is a little difficult to read, but the numbers that are in parentheses are the peak hour from 4 to 6 p.m., and the other data that was gathered in September of 2012. And the other number, the second number in the grouping there, is the number of 24-hour counts, if you will, from October of 2016. So, again, we've been collecting data, trying to establish a database for the purposes of some metrics in some of these corridors. So that's been an ongoing activity. The other thing that we've been looking at is vehicle bike crashes from 2006 and 2015. This is data that we get from MnDOT. This is not data we collect independently, but MnDOT has this data available to us. So by location, the red dots, and then basically further by year in the chart in the lower left, showing that we peaked in 2011 with 27 bicycle identified as bicycle crashes that were reported. And again, I think this, again, is only the data is only as good as what gets reported and is put into the database. But we've seen that number come down to, in 2015, we have 14. We don't have the results yet from 2016 or 2017 from MnDOT. So as part of the master plan, we created this matrix that, again, shows, identified some priorities. And the different colors here represent the different priorities. So to be honest with you, I'm not sure why the categories were identified as high cost, moderate cost, or lower cost, other than to distinguish them that way. But you can see that we've been making some progress. The two projects in yellow have been completed. The ones in purple are under construction or design. And the ones in blue are in the in conceptual planning stage. And the other ones are currently in the CIP. So virtually every project on the list is in some stage of completeness or under consideration for implementation. So the next slide here is, again, a lot of information, but it's just an implementation of infrastructure projects. Basically shows that for 5 years, the different projects that have been implemented, showing by column here, the route, the location, the type of improvement, the bicycle master plan recommendation and basically whether it was consistent or inconsistent with the bicycle master plan. Most of them were consistent, but some of them were inconsistent. And basically, in many of those cases where they were inconsistent, a higher level facility was provided. I'd be happy to go over any of these with you to refresh your memory on why we did that. But all of those were public projects that were initiated through a council-approved contract. So, again, a lot of information on this slide, but basically just showing some of the status that we have, the status of what we've been able to accomplish in 5 years. Basically, two-thirds of the projects that we've done are consistent with the recommendations in the plan, but the tables on the right show basically the amount of improvement. So, for example, signed bike routes, there's 29.84 proposed in the plan. We've only been able to, or so far, have only implemented a half a mile of that. As far as bike lanes are concerned, we've they're 22.19 proposed in the plan, but 10.87 have actually been constructed. Now, that 10.87 is reflective of the fact that more bike lanes have been constructed than were originally proposed in the plan, particularly on newer projects such as Badger Hills Drive Northwest, for example, past the new Hy-Vee. That project was not in the plan in 2012. It was not part of the 22.19, but there's about three-quarters of a mile of additional bike lanes there. So again, we're tracking, we're measuring, we're keeping metrics on all of this stuff for the purpose of reporting back to you and to others. The lower right-hand corner shows the number of crossings, so basically the proposed facilities, the proposed crossing improvements, so the number of projects that have been implemented there, not a lot, but we've been making progress on several of these categories. So in the last the last specific slide related to the master plan is from, again, the ROCOG long-range transportation plan, which shows that for the 2040 plan that was adopted, that we were looking at an investment in the vicinity of about 2.5% of the overall necessary investment for transportation, and that's transportation, that's transit, capital, and operating, as well as roadway expansion and preservation. So, percentage-wise, a very small percentage of the overall transportation funding dollar, if you will, about 2.5 cents per dollar going toward those facilities. I'd like to transition quickly then into the complete streets thing and then be happy to answer any questions. So in your packet was a copy of the complete streets resolution that was adopted on March 2nd of 2009. If you recall, those of you who were on the council, we were the first city in Minnesota to adopt such an ordinance. I think the second government agency, or the third government agency overall. The staff, as prescribed in the ordinance, for the policy, I'm sorry, reviews the feasibility to provide facilities and amenities for all users of the public right-of-way within the project limits. So whenever there's a project identified as maintenance, reconstruction, significant maintenance, reconstruction, or rehabilitation, we then take the, again, I do want to pass these out since I made copies of it for you. Here are copies from this year, and actually these are on your agenda tonight. This document isn't part of the packet, but this is a worksheet, a checklist that we developed several years ago that we use for every single project, and it's titled the City's Complete Street Checklist. And so the packet here tonight is of the three projects that are on your agenda tonight under reports and recommendations. And this is a checklist that we go through for every single project where we look, when we're looking to implement complete streets. And there's a series of questions here. There's front and back, there's about four total pages. And we go through, and the design engineer will go through and prepare this document, and then the staff will discuss it and make a determination as to what we should do next, okay? And whether the project meets the intent of a complete street or if it doesn't. So this is done for every single project. I just wanted to share that with you. I haven't shared it with you in the past, but it's being something that's being done, and it's the basis under which we make our recommendations coming forward. So we go through and we prepare this, and one of the questions in here is consistency with other adopted plans. Do any of the adopted plans call for the development of transit access or services, pedestrian or bicycle facilities on or crossing the project? And if the answer to that is yes, then we refer to things like the comp plan and the long range transportation plan and the bicycle master plan. So then the staff makes, and again, this is evolved over the years as the council has sought to be more involved in the decision-making process on the implementation of complete streets. We have brought, the staff presents a recommendations on the proposed complete streets improvements on local streets to each individual ward council member for a discussion and decision, so on local streets. As is the case tonight, for those three projects that are on your agenda this evening, for those that involve arterials and collector streets, we bring that forward for the entire council to make a decision on and have discussion regarding the implementation of complete streets. So whether it's, again, it's a conversion of four lanes to three, whether it's the addition of bike lanes or sharrows or whatever the case may be, in the case of a local street, we work with a local ward council person on that. In the case of collectors and arterials, which are more reflective of the streets used by the entire community, we bring that to the council for decision. Now, this process has evolved over since 2009. I think the first several years, the staff was doing this administratively. The council asked that they have an opportunity to review particularly the major streets, and we brought that back, and now this is the process we use. So during that time, and you remember from one of the slides I mentioned the improvements that were inconsistent in some cases, and also on that list were projects that the council had not approved. And here's a series of projects that we have made recommendations consistent with the bicycle master plan that the council did not support. So again, these items have come to you, you've made decisions on them, and so from a process perspective, there are certain projects that come before you, there are certain projects that don't, but the ones that have, you've had an opportunity to vote them up or down. So next steps. I understand there's discussion about wanting to review the bicycle master plan. We're indicating to you that there's an intent to update the bicycle master plan concurrent with the update of the ROCOG long range transportation plan, which is a 2045 plan, which is scheduled to be completed in 2020. During that process, we would seek citizen input along the way. We'd also seek input and review of the pedestrian bicycle advisory committee, and obviously it would come back to you here at a subsequent committee of the whole meeting, or maybe possibly several of those. Obviously, we want to make sure we're consistent with the comprehensive plan update and continue a phased implementation as set forth by the Complete Streets policy. I know some of the things that you've heard and some of the questions that several of you asked me is that, well, we're making this improvement on this particular four or five or six block area, but it doesn't connect to anything on either end. And I know that's been a concern for you, it's been a concern for citizens who call us about that, is that it's great that you put that in, but I can't connect to anything on the either end. And the issue always has been is that we're not doing all the streets at the same time, so as we get a chance in particular areas of the community, we implement that piece of the network that we can. And the hope would be that as, you know, adjacent pieces, be they on either end or connecting to the corridors get implemented, that we would then be able to complete the network. So it's kind of a chicken and the egg, or build it and they will come. And we're kind of in that situation now as we're attempting to implement this a piece at a time. The Complete Streets resolution talks about that, though, that that's the way that the program should be implemented. So I will stop talking and start answering questions that you may have of me.
All right. Questions, comments on either of those topics? Mr. Hickey.
So I think I still have a lot of the same concerns I had with the bicycle master plan. That seems to be more so than the complete streets. It's more an overarching policy. Bicycle master plan is kind of the nuts and bolts. So it's a six-year-old plan that's still driving our decisions. And I think one of the biggest pieces missing, we as a council attempted to address this a year ago, is just the to get that feedback and input from the people that are being impacted. So you look at the projects tonight, you know, unless someone happens to be breezing through their council agenda, you know, the first thing they're going to know is when the no parking signs go up in front of their house. So we had, a year ago, we had passed council-initiated action to have a process or to develop a process presented to the council for notification. So, for example, these projects tonight, we would have had an opportunity to send out postcards, get some citizen input. All those people that are impacted by this, they won't even know until the no parking signs go up. We talked before about having a, you know, high threshold. I mean, before we take away, I haven't heard any complaints about adding recreational trails, adding bike lanes and new developments where the right-of-way allows. The biggest heartburn people have is when we convert existing vehicle lanes and parking lanes for bike lanes. And again, I think there needs to be a pretty high threshold, and I think we need to do some community engagement. So again, I would maintain these projects that are coming before us tonight. The people that are going to be most impacted by it have no idea it's coming, and they won't know until it's too late. And I think that's a problem. So I don't know, for the input or the council-initiated action from a year ago, is there any plan to move forward with that? Or
we can. There is a plan in place that says what we're supposed to do, and what we're doing is following that plan. So I think what you're asking is not to change the plan, but change the process.
Just to provide some input. So, look at the end. For this tonight, these are coming under what? Reports and recommendations. So it's not even a public hearing. And people have no idea this is coming. So, I mean, I sent out my little Word update to a few hundred people, but this isn't front page news in the paper. People aren't going to know it's coming. So they don't have the input for things that aren't going to concern, you know, impact them directly.
Mr. Campion.
So this seemed like a process we don't go through that often, and I have maybe a different, but hopefully complementary and not necessarily opposing view, which is that I worry about bringing all of these decisions up as huge maps and getting thumbs up, thumbs down from the council on every one, because I really feel decisions like this should be done at a strategic level, and we shouldn't be potentially, without having the full system view, burning system level decision making on a project by project basis. It really concerns me from that perspective. These are broad investments that impact the entire city. And to have it come up as kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down, which alternative do you want, with very little recommendation from staff, which I understand their hesitation to give, frankly, given kind of how turbulent some of our decision-making has been on this. But I think overall, we all like seeing systems that function better together, and we all know a good system that's functioning well. I understand that our system is piece by piece, but I worry that taking the decision-making down to such a micro level for what's really a macro decision for the city, we really risk making some poor decisions just based on our appetite for a single project, when that may actually have broad ramifications well beyond that project. I'm going to go ahead, and I'm not trying to thumb my nose at the reports tonight, but I didn't see that level of discussion being had about, you know, how instrumental is this particular component to the overall objective we're trying to achieve here. So I think that maybe complemented with Councilmember Hickey's concern regarding whether or not those people who are going to be impacted, I certainly want to give them an input. I don't know that we want to be beholden to their input. I think part of that is, like, sometimes those strategic objectives override the local decision, but I guess I agree with that comment, and I guess I would add my own to that.
Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Wagner.
Yeah, so you make a good point, and I've talked about it before. I did mention it today, but just if we had a better understanding of how this all fits together and what is still, you know, what is still valid. So things that were valid 6 years ago, things have changed in this city. So my concern is we're just rolling out the appendices to the Bicycle Master Plan and saying, yep, it's in appendix, let's go for it. So if we had an idea that, yep, this is critical, and like you said, you're not going to please everybody, so we get that public input and go, you know what, we heard what you say, but this is the key piece that gets us to the next level of implementation. So it's to have the whole plan.
And I want it for a reason that will help. It will help me convince council members that may not want to support every piece of bike infrastructure to then be able to point at the plans and look at the strategic value of this piece versus what kind of looks like a map with some painting on it, which I think is the wrong way to look at these investments. These are strategic investments. I think you guys do actually make a lot of strategic decision making. It's just, it isn't reflective in terms of what comes before the council to vote on.
Hey, Ms. Roger.
And I also want to point out too that I believe the staff recommendation for all three of them tonight is to include the bike lanes. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Was there a recommendation? I must have been reading too quickly.
Presented as options or a recommendation?
No, I mean, you're right. We weren't sure what to do with this because of all the conversation there has been, particularly during the comp plan discussion about this, and not sure, again, what the concern was here. So we weren't, we did not make a recommendation, but the staff does support the implementation of the improvements that are consistent with the Bicycle Master Plan. I'm struggling again to, you know, these are the maps that we're all referring to that are in the document that show, for example, how 14th Street north of east is, you know, it's in here, this is how it all connects. Granted, it's not in the packet, but...
That's exactly it. I mean, yeah. I'm going to step on your toes, but you're exactly right. Like, your guys' full-time job is to care about the Bike Master Plan and about the finances of the Public Works Department and everything that flows from that, but this criticism is entirely, frankly, about the process of it coming forward to the council. Like, what I see today doesn't equip the council to make a strategic decision about either of the alternatives. It's, here are two alternatives. And, I mean, right or wrong, I think I understand exactly how you guys got there, because I've been part of those difficult conversations, but I want to propel us past that. Like, we need to make those tough decisions and go forward.
And I'm going to grab... what I wanted to continue and say is that that's an opportunity tonight, is I'm going to specifically ask staff why in their professional recommendation the lane should be put in. But in short, all the three of the ones that we have proposed tonight represent routes where no safe route exists and no reasonable alternative to it could exist. And that makes it a fairly easy decision, which is, I believe, why staff thinks it's the right thing to do.
Yes, that is Councilmember Wojcik's opinion. Is my
right.
Hard part here.
Well,
I think we have professional staff who have been making good professional recommendations.
And I expect that'll be the recommendation tonight.
I've said that.
Okay. Mr. Bilderbeck, then Mr. Ruskin.
Richard, I think what would help us is if we knew if there were connector routes. I think the misconception out there is every street's going to have a bike lane or share on it, and that's not true. But I think what would help us, as you talked earlier about the 10 miles out of the 29 proposed, or in the master plan, is if they're connector routes. Have we put pieces in place, and is this going to help connect it and make it a complete area? And that's where I think the biggest struggles are, because we get into these things, do we need one, do we not need one? But again, if we knew if it was a connector, if this is going to be one of the thoroughways, that would help us. And we don't all carry the map around with us to figure that out. So if you could let us know that, that would help us, I believe.
Mr. Ruskin.
Well, I think, at least in my eyes and my experience that I've seen here, is the biggest thing that's missing is the balance. We seem to have bike lanes and bike shares and everything that's put all over town, and people are getting confused and I think frustrated with it. At least that's what I hear a lot of. I was reading the Bicycle Master Plan this weekend, and on page 5, there's some interesting things in here. It said that there's an estimated 1,200 trips per day into the downtown Rochester by bicycle, 1,200 per day. And there's an estimated 11,000 trips per day during the riding season in our city. I don't see that. I mean, that's a lot. And I don't know that the riding season is, maybe that's just a couple of days, but 11,000 per day is something that I think some of these things are a little bit out of focus, but I think we still need to figure out how to create good transportation opportunities for people that are on bicycles and try to promote it. One of the things that also is on that same page is that they talk about local residents' reaction to increased bike lanes on area roadways, and of that is either very positive or positive, 66% of the people. Now, I just wonder if we went out, now after we've had all these bike lanes put on roads and asked again, I'd wonder if they're 66%. Because I know that, like, on Pinewood Road, as Councilmember Hickey was referring to, Pinewood Road put in bike lanes and all the people were fine with it. And as soon as they found out that they were losing all their parking and the schools didn't have, when the schools had their events, they didn't have where to park their people, the phones lit up because they didn't understand that that was happening. I went out there this winter. The bike lanes are all covered with snow. There's a sidewalk that's plowed, but there's a bike lanes that have all these signs and all this painting, but they're all covered with snow. So obviously, no one's using them. So those are some things that are challenging. I think paths along the bike lanes, when people see these nice paths, which I am totally 100% supportive of us putting a network together where people can travel safe throughout the community without having a lot of interaction with vehicles. I think it's safer, and it's. I know for families, they're going to take people out on that. They aren't excited about using those bike lanes where they're dealing with the vehicles. And then the lanes that cut through intersections, when you see that, I was on 2nd Street the other day, and when it gets out to, I think it's Circle Drive, the lane cuts over into the middle between two vehicle lanes, and I just don't see people feeling comfortable using things like that. So, and then finally, I'm not sure that the bikers care about the lanes. I watch a lot of bikers. Today I saw one drive right on 3rd Street where we put the new light in so they could go across. They went across the red light, you know, kind of looking both ways. They cut down through roads wherever they want to go. I've had bikers that have told me, frankly, I don't like the bike lanes because I want to drive where I want to drive. And so, you know, there's a lot of different things that we're dealing with here, and I think it's a few years after we've put all this together. I think there's good people that we have in our community working to try to improve the bicycle efforts. I printed this out, and this is something that you've already referred to, Richard. This is a pretty confusing document. There's a lot of stuff on here. And this is, you know, to me, this needs to be simplified. It needs to be more focused on certain areas and certain ways that people have a way to get around town, but not every single way. And one of the things tonight that we're going to vote on is 19th Street. Mm-hmm. I understand that that's the way that we need to get people across, but boy, that's challenging right now with vehicles. That's a confusing intersection. Now we're going to put bike lanes through there, and how are they going to navigate through all the conflicts with traffic is a big concern. So I don't know if there's an easy way. I just know that people are getting fed up with all the you know, we don't have money to fix roads, but we got money to put bike lanes and bike signs and paintings and stuff all over town. And I think it's time we just clean up the process a little bit and figure out what we're doing so we can all be on the same page on this.
All right. Anyone else? As Mr. Freeze said, we've got three specific projects this evening, but Mr. Hickey.
I'll just circle back to the original point I made. So the April 16th last year was the council initiated action to get up to come forward with the process. Whether we adopt that process eventually, you know, we may not. But there's a lot of lip service paid to community engagement, and we need to be consistent when it's maybe answers we don't all want to hear. So in the end, I fully agree. If it's a strategic park, and you know, we're not going to please everybody, but I think it's important that people at least have notice and they know these decisions that are being made that are going to impact them.
All right. Anyone else? Good conversation. Obviously not a topic that we have absolute agreement on, and there are some philosophical differences as well as how we execute it in a clean fashion that serves the most people in the best way possible. So it can't be.
I guess I would just comment that I think there's a lot of common ground here. Like, I think it's too bad to focus on all the disagreement. I think how we do on-road bike transit in a safe way is something we all want to find the right answer to. And, you know, I don't think anyone claims to have found the perfect answer yet. I think a lot of your criticisms are criticisms that I've heard and that we probably all heard. Along with the citizen feedback, I guess I also want to work to make sure we're equipped to make the best strategic decision for the community, and frankly, to be able to share that vision with the constituents who come up and ask, you know, why are we putting bike lanes here? To be able to explain why that may reduce the long range cost of that roadway, that might reduce speeds, and we talk about that stuff. But you know, I just appreciate it coming forward, and appreciate maybe an answer to that question, and some talking about how we frame these. If they're going to be council decisions, let's work on just getting it framed up so we can make the best possible decision.
Mr. Ruskin?
Yeah, ultimately, Councilmember Campion's right. We want people to be able to get around the community at their willingness, but also very safe. And I don't know that what we're setting up right now is safe. And so I'd just like us to reanalyze a little bit, look at it, and figure out how we can maybe come together on something that works for everybody.
My concern is also the safety. I think that's important that, we would not necessarily figure out our own procedures to do an apt, to take out a vital organ. You would let a doctor do that. And just as that, we have professional staff who has training in what actually is and is not safer. And I think it's important that we ask those questions and make sure they give us an answer. But a lot of things when it comes to cycling, it's counterintuitive. What is the safest? And but at least staff can answer those questions for us.
I always look at it when you take, if you're going to take your family out, if you're going to take your kids out riding, where are you going to go? And if you're if you're in a scenario you're not going to go, that's not very safe.
Yeah, and I think this is part of the feedback we heard a lot during the DMC plan was the fact that there are about four different groups of riders. You have the riders, like Ed made reference to, that want to go where they want to go, and call those the fearless. It's about 10%. Then you have about 60% of people who would actually ride their bike to work and ride it recreationally on the street if there were safe facilities provided. And then there are the rest that basically really like the comfort of an off-street trail. Because again, it's not a commute, it's not a work to trip, it's not a work to shopping, it's a recreational activity. And so there are different user groups that have different expectations. And it's really, it's not easy trying to meet all of those. We've been attempting to do that with, again, on-road and off-road, but there are a group of riders that want to be on-road. And again, it's trying to meet their needs. The other point I'd like to make is that it's really difficult to go into a public process with and tell people their opinion is valued when it is, in most cases, isn't going to make a difference. That's what's really hard about these things. You've already decided what's going to happen on that road. You've adopted a plan that says this is what's going to happen. Notifying them that it's going to happen is one thing, but going to them asking them for their input, basically, that says, well, you get a vote here. And that's a hard part of this outreach process that we, planning staff and Public Works, goes through on a lot of these things, where it's leading them to an expectation that their input really is valued, and we really do have a concern about safety issues and everything else. But at the end of the day, are you really going to value that input that you get from the 50 people who live along that road, or the 5,000 people who may drive that road every day, or basically the people who want an opportunity to commute? I mean, so again, that's the challenge in all of this, is that, you know, what group ultimately speaks the loudest or has the most weight or makes the most persuasive argument, that's difficult.
Could I ask a different question? Are there any bike lanes that you've put in that you have maybe rethought, maybe that was a mistake or against your better judgment? And the example I'll use is the bike lane along 41st Street Northwest. That one, to me, and I drive that road frequently, that looks like it's totally unsafe. I mean, as you know, there's parallel parking there. All somebody has to do is crack a door. And
the mistake we made there was not recommending to you the removal of parking on one side of the street. That was the mistake that was made there. Not that we put the bike lanes there, that we basically tried to fit it all in, kept the parking, and again, if people park in the area that's designated for them to park, there is enough room for the bike lane. But people don't park against the curb. They park, they're legally allowed to park, was it a foot or 18 inches away before they get a ticket? And so that's the challenge there. But to do that one over, we would have recommended you eliminate parking on one side.
Which, of course, creates the other challenge. We have a vast shortage of parking, so anytime we implement one of these where we take away parking, because that's next to a park that we see a lot of frequent parallel parking there, so I can see why they would want to keep that.
Yeah. So, but again, none of the recommendations tonight eliminate any travel lanes. What they are impacting is parking on one side of the street.
Right. Again, there's no easy answer on some of these when you have a finite amount of right-of-way. Mr. Wood.
And just, I would say that it's important to remember, too, this applies to this, the TOD, the comp plan, everything else that we do. The right answer for the entire community is not always the right answer for individuals within that community. I had to stare that straight down when we had the water tank up by St. Mary's. which clearly my constituents didn't like. We heard about that, but that was clearly the right decision for the community, even though there were some people that it did negatively affect more than other options would have.
Mr. Bildebeck.
And even, you know, these are good discussions to have, and you can go to different cities and see that they're also having the same discussion. Yesterday, in a competitor's newspaper in the cities, there was a large article about bicycles and quite a bit of input. We've talked about trying different things here, the protected bike lanes going through town, but that's not even unanimous when you talk to groups. Mm-hmm. You'll find that some don't like it, some want different types of barriers. Then we also have the idea of how to equate them in the winter, because we do have a segment of the bicycle population that rides year-round. So it is a challenge. I think having these types of discussions, taking a look at these places when you go to different areas. I was just back in D.C. last week and got to see some of the things that they're doing, trying to do. Is it 100% safe? No. But they're further along than we are in the way that they're doing things. This is an opportunity for all of us to be able to share our ideas and thoughts and try to come up with the best idea. There isn't one that works for everybody. I think, as Richard said, there's four different classes that they've identified of people to use these bike lanes. And that's the same way we can say with our drivers. We have some drivers who think stop signs are suggestions as well as stop lights. And so it's trying to find something that works. But I think the whole idea is that we need to keep in mind that our goal is to get people through the city and to their destinations safely.
So again, one thing I would just ask the council to consider in your deliberations later this evening is that a lot of people have an opinion on those three projects and whether we should do option one or not option two. All I would say is that, and Randy, I indicated this in an email to you today, is that until that facility is built, I have nothing to measure against. In other words, I can do a before study, but I don't have an after study until there's there. And the only thing that we're doing with each of these three projects is where we're placing the pavement lanes. So in other words, where the center line might be and whether there's going to be initial stripe for the bike lane. Every 5 years, those lanes have to be redone. So basically, maybe the way to look at this from a policy perspective is let's, you know, consider implementing them with the understanding that every single one of them, or at least ones that you, by motion, indicate you want to see them back in 5 years, to come back and do the metrics, do the before and after. One thing that I believe that we're going to be able to demonstrate over time is that wherever we've gone from a 4-to-3 conversion on a roadway, we will see a significant reduction in the speed. Mm-hmm. Okay, the 85th percentile will come down significantly. And the reason being is that people aren't able to weave in and out from lane to lane going through the corridor, and we've all experienced that. Now, basically, the speed is controlled by that driver that wants to drive the speed limit. And so, again, it's taking longer to travel through the corridor for some, but we've seen a significant reduction in speed, and I know that all of you receive a lot of complaints about speeding. So it's one thing that we've been able to do that hasn't affected traffic for pretty much 23 hours out of the day. And for the rest of the time, it's had some impact on positive speed reduction.
Okay. Mr. Campion, you had a comment?
Oh, no. I was just supporting his statement. We've seen, and 41st Street's an interesting example, because I've heard from two people that live along that street that they actually like the bike lanes being there because they feel like it's had a practical effect on people traveling and that they find it easier getting out of their driveways, which has been one of the challenges for them for a long time. So it is, you know, how do you demonstrate some of those quality of life changes that happen without having the project? That's certainly kind of a challenge. So.
Ms. Johnson?
I'm going to just go back to the specific example of 41st Street, is that I see a number of people passing in those bike lanes, which drives me crazy. So they will pass on the right-hand side through the bike lanes, which is dangerous for anybody who's traveling in those lanes, be it pedestrians, skateboarders, or bicyclists.
All right. Anyone else on this topic? So it sounded like from your next steps you'll be reevaluating or perhaps suggesting updates to the plan based on the proposed comp plan or ROCOG updates, yeah, et cetera.
The update of the ROCOG long-range transportation plan has already begun.
Yep.
So I think if you're agreeable, I think to do this in conjunction with that would make the most sense, since it was kind of a part of it initially. And the timeline would be, again, something completed in by 2020.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Anyone else? Mr. Wojcik?
Just other business.
All right. Well, let's move to other business. Mr. Wojcik.
Okay. I sent out to the council following up on some discussion from last year. I don't know if you guys have been getting this too, but I've had a lot of press inquiries, particularly dealing with the Convention and Visitors Bureau after all the news. And in particular, I'm interested in, last year I got a copy of the conflict of interest policy. So I sent some questions out. I guess it would be to Mr. Reimer and Mr. Staver. And you know, the three questions I'm trying to get answered is, who's currently responsible for monitoring and enforcing the compliance with the policy? You know, how are the conflicts of interest pertaining to venues that compete with Mayo Civic Center addressed? And then lastly, you know, when this came up last year, I raised concerns about the conflicts of interest in the overseeing of the Arts Trust and the RCVB. I assume that given that policy, somebody on the inside analyzed the relationship and determined that there wasn't a conflict of interest. But based on the city attorney's decision on being public data, I assume that information can be shared now in terms of how that issue was analyzed on the inside. So, and I don't need answers today, but I did want to, just because I've been getting so many questions on this, I do want to follow up and see how we're addressing conflicts of interest per that policy.
Let me just take one of the yeah. first question first, and this is more of a question for the city yeah. attorney. Whether it's CBB or any other private organization, how any organization monitors or polices their conflict of interest, wouldn't that be inherent to whatever that board is in their internal processes? I don't know how you'd answer that otherwise. I mean, any board is
yeah.
subject to monitoring right. their own actions,
but
in terms
of... You understand, because you're on that board and that executive right. committee. You know how it's being done, right?
Right.
Yeah. How is it being done?
It's very simple. As I think Brad Jones okay. sent out the conflict of interest policy,
yep.
which is reviewed annually primarily for the benefit of any new board members, such that people understand what it means, conflict of interest, and when they can or cannot, should or should not recuse. I'm just asking a more general question that any board, name a board around town, and they are going to police their own internal action based on whatever policies they have.
Well, and I understand. This one's, you know, near and dear to my heart, because they're getting millions of dollars of taxpayer money every year. And, you know, in particular, and I did ask the specific question, too, and I'll be looking for some follow-up on that, on what was the determination between the trust and the RCVB. Because that was a question that was asked last year, and I assume there had to have been board discussion on it. And a lot of the examples that were brought up were using that document. So I want to just understand what the policies are, because if it was a public organization, there'd be public processes to address this. Because it's a private, there's no public process. Everything has to be done internally.
I guess I'd like to know if we have a consensus on all this, because if Councilmember Wojcik has a personal issue with these two agencies, which he sort of seems to, I would ask if all of us feel that way, because I know for my fact, when we do our board members, we have a conflict of interest statement that we give to them. I know when I'm on Ready, we get it. It's really hard to get everybody even to return the things, because people just don't always pay attention. You get them, you put them in a pile, you keep them there. Part of your 990 filing, you have to document that you have them and you have them available, but I don't know what all these things are. I don't know who does. I don't know that anybody has these answers. But I would think that all the groups are working in the best interest that they know to do. And I don't know that there is safeguards that every conflict of interest policy is scrutinized. And I don't even know what we do with these at times. And I don't know what other groups do with them. So I think these are challenges. But I guess foremost, I'd like to know if we have a consensus that this is something that we need to continue to beat on.
Anyone else care to comment? Mr. Campion?
So it seems well within Councilmember Wojcik's right to ask the questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think
looking for answers from the RCBB.
Yes.
Or the ER.
Or from our representatives on it.
I think asking the questions is perfectly within, mm-hmm. you're right. I think people should offer the information that they see fit, and we'll see what kind of answer comes out of that. And then if that proves insufficient, then you'd consider what you need to do next. I don't think that there's any reason to blow this into a bigger battle yet, because this may be information they're perfectly happy to share. So hopefully that's the way it is, and that it isn't a bigger issue for anyone.
Mr. Russell.
And I'm just sharing from our viewpoint as the executive director of our organization. I have 27 board members. I have them fill it out every year. I try to get three or four that never turn it in. I don't think there's any reason. It's very difficult to know what to do with these when you get them, and when people are board members don't. In essence, your board is your oversight group, so it's pretty hard to demand it from them. So these are some challenging issues that I think all organizations go through, and I just don't know that we should single one out. If we were going to look at them all and say that this is a challenge with all of them, what are the precedents? If we're going to set something for it, then it should be all of our city organizations. So.
And everything that's public is already covered. We've got process for everything that's public. Mm-hmm. So that's almost all of our boards.
Well, there's RDA, there's Ready, there's
Those are private.
Different groups out there. We have probably a pretty good handful of them that are out there.
Right, this is the only one that is entirely taxpayer funded.
But I think in the spirit of consistency, why would you not ask the same question?
I encourage you to ask that question of everybody. I'm just looking forward to getting the answers to these three questions.
So then you are broadening your request to all of the groups?
No, I'm not, but you may.
So you're singling out one organization?
Yes.
Is there a particular reason?
Yes. I did not get an answer on the conflict. To me personally, and now of course I'm just stating my opinion, as you know, the council felt that it was a conflict of interest to have one of our members serving on a private organization, but due to the veto and the inability to override, that is continuing. I take exception in particular to the president or the chairperson of a board of one private organization leasing space for free to that same organization. It seems to me like it overtly violates the conflict of interest that your organization has accepted. And as a result of that, I want to see how your organization came to the conclusion that that's not a conflict of interest. Okay. And if I had a similar example with another organization, I would be asking that as well. But in this particular case, here's where I see a pretty clear conflict and no path to address it.
Yeah, I think these are, questions the organization should be perfectly willing to demystify. I mean, if this is feeling like it's not clear, they have an ample opportunity to respond and to answer and to clear it up for everyone so there's no further confusion about what's happening and how they're applying the process.
Okay. So that seems to be the main outstanding question, is how space was allocated to another organization.
The reason I put it in writing was so that everyone would have those same three questions that I asked. Those are the three questions that are outstanding.
Okay. All right, anything else for this afternoon? Then we are adjourned. See everyone this evening.
Nope, I want Mr. Engel.
Yeah. Everybody wants.
I can see that.
Excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry.